From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Former Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce has been in the news recently, and not just for his role of Special Envoy on Drought. The drought position was offered to him in Scott Morrison's reshuffle. It is not a front bench post, but it has given him a high profile and a lot of opportunity to travel in the Nationals' heartland territory. There has now been talk that some Nationals would like to see Barnaby Joyce return as leader before the election. These supporters argue that he cuts through much better than the present leader, Michael McCormack. Barnaby Joyce joins us today ahead of the government's special summit on drought on Friday, which will be held in Canberra. Barnaby Joyce, let's start with your work as Special Drought Envoy. Could you give us an update on where things are with the drought? There has been some rain recently in some areas. Has this done anything to provide real alleviation, or is it just scratching the surface?
No, it has. We should always be honest. We've had really good rain in some areas, and that has provided real relief. But of course, the real relief does not become evident until such time as the money turns up at the bank. So, for instance, I've had 2.5-3 inches of rain, which is, you know, 60-70 millimetres. And now what I need, of course, is the grass to grow, and then for the cattle and the sheep to eat the grass, and then for me to sell fat lambs or fat steers. That's how I keep my bank manager happy. Telling him it's rain does not pay the bill, and that's just, I've been very fortunate. Other areas haven't had that sort of rain, and we have to make sure we keep their economies going. Now, the first part of your question, you asked, what am I doing? Well, I've been collecting all this information and funneling it back to the Prime Minister and also the coordinator, Major General Stephen Day. And at the end of this week, we have both a finance meeting with the banks and also a drought forum of 100 selected people so that we can really sort of deliver an outcome. And I do believe that Prime Minister Morrison is serious about this. I don't think he's going through the rhetoric. I really do think that this is, that he's got his heart set on making a difference.
Just broadly, who is going to that drought summit?
Well, the Prime Minister, the Agricultural Minister, myself, Major General Stephen Day, mayors of towns, peak farming body representatives from the New South Wales farmers, Jackson from Gyra, Fiona Simpson will be there. There is, you know, people through the length and breadth in our area. Mayor Cole Murray, who's in Tamworth, which is one of the epicentres of the area. Russ Webb, everybody wants to be there, but we obviously have to limit the numbers somewhat.
Will the government be offering more initiatives either this Friday or in the wake of that meeting, or have we seen all that will be done?
I think we have to look. We have, the thing about this is the people who really hurt are the people in the towns. See, the farmers still have the equity in their property, and that property, even in the middle of a drought, it will hold its value or appreciate. But if you have the hardware store in town or the white goods store, a drought can send you out the back door in such a way as you have nothing. There is no one who wants to buy your shop, no one wants to take over your lease, and there is no spare cash in the district to keep you going. So we've got to make sure we get the economy of these areas, such as Longreach, such as what we are doing in Tenderfield with the roadworks, and make sure that they are incorporating capital works that keep their local economy going, whether it's dog fences, whether it's water infrastructure, whether it's road upgrades. These are the sort of things that keep the economies going.
So are we looking to more aid to local councils or direct to some of these local businesses or to the farmers so they can spend the money? The thinking?
All the above. There's been in excess of a $70 million package to councils that gives councils $1 million each. And I'll give you an example of one council, Walker, which talks about upgrading their showgrounds, upgrading the Bullbrook Stampede grounds and Aundock showgrounds. Why would it do that? Because it'll use local hardware from the local hardware store. It'll employ local people. It's jobs that locals can do. So that's council work. There's a farm household allowance, which is a direct cash payment to people on the land, so that's direct to the farmers. And then there are other roles and services provided by the government that need to be supported, and there are other things in the pipeline. We'll find more about them after the forum on the end of the week.
That's what's been done, but in looking at further aid, you would really be looking at topping up those sorts of programs.
I think there's... Well, they mentioned the figure $1.8 billion has been spent. Now, if you told me to break that down, I wouldn't be able to. I'd have to look that up. But what we do need is to make sure that, for instance, the Muttaburra Longreach Road, that, you know, if we do that up, that helps the local town Torrens Creek section right up there near Hughenden. That'll help that economy. Baduri to Birdsville, if we seal that last section of road, that'll help that local economy and also leave a legacy that makes makes it not money wasted, but money that actually left the area in a better situation after the drought.
So to sum up, there's more to come in these various areas.
Yes.
Okay. Now, researchers from the Bureau of Agricultural and Research Economics, in an article that we published on The Conversation today, note concerns that drought support can discourage farmers from preparing for future droughts, including those brought on by climate change. What's your view on that?
Well, first thing I could say that, fire stations can discourage people from having proper fire prevention measures. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't have fire prevention measures and also have a fire brigade. You need both. And I think it's a very, cutting way to look at things to say, well, we just won't support you anymore and that way you'll get better. Because if we use that theory, then let's say, look, if you don't have private health insurance, you won't be allowed into a public hospital. Unless you can pay for the roads, you're not allowed on them. Let's just get rid of schools, hospitals, a lot.
These authors canvassed the possibility of insurance products where payouts would be based on weather data rather than an assessment of farm damage. Would that be a good course, do you think?
Well, I mean, we've tried, and I've tried, to get multi-peril crop insurance going in the past, and it's you need a wide body of people to take it up to make it work, and always seem to be unable to do that. What we've had in the past is the people who take it up are the ones who seem to be able to claim on it, and therefore the insurers don't come back. However, and here's breaking news for you, Michelle, I've been having a conversation with David Murray about how we could possibly do this better, and he's suggesting we get a panel of people together from the major insurers. He's with AMP now, to try and organise a creation of a product that might be able to further mitigate the reason for the government's involvement by providing an insurance product that is accessible and able to be purchased by people.
I want to turn to another topic now. A Four Corners report this week highlighted that the gun lobby is pretty active at the moment. What's your view on the pressure to liberalise the national firearms regime? Do you think there should be changes made, or do you think it's appropriate as is?
Well, I think there are two things that need to be balanced. Now, in a drought all the time, you're going out what they call destroying stock, which means you have to shoot them because they're down and they can't get up. And you need to be able to do that immediately, and you need to be able to do that without, you know... For people on the land, a rifle is a tool of trade. It is not a... People say it's a sporting item. It's not. It's a tool of trade.
But it's accessible now.
Yes, and I don't want to see that... But we've had a bad history, and this is where the cynicism builds up, Michelle, is every time governments tell us they're not going to get more involved in our lives, they do. In vegetation management laws, they say it won't be so bad, then it is. And then in new water restrictions, and then in putting in dams. And even they said that it wouldn't be a cost centre making money. But now even the cost of registering a firearm is becoming more and more expensive. And so I think what's got to happen here is people understand the sentiment of the government. We can't have people running around threatening people's lives. And other people, I think, clearly understand that for people on the land, a rifle definitely is a tool of trade and you need it. And it's also, for many people, a recreational pursuit, and they should not be derided because of that. But military assault weapons are a completely different kettle of fish. And I think that, I think we've pretty much got the balance right. And I but I don't want to, you know, it's very, if you're not around firearms, it's very easy to be skeptical of firearms and to always think that the world, you know, that the best thing is to move more and more towards totally banning them. That would make life incredibly difficult, because I'll give you an example. A beast is down in a dam, it's bogged. Are you going to climb in there and try and pull it out, in the water? Or are you going to have to destroy it first, shoot it, and then put a rope around its neck and pull it out? Well, of course, you have to destroy it first. But, you know, if you don't have a firearm, what are you going to do? What, hit it on the head with a brick? I mean, what are you going to do? Try and cut its throat with a knife? How are you going to do this?
Let's turn to some general political questions. All the polling shows that the government's in a poor position for next year's election. In 2016, you as leader ran a very separate campaign from that of the Liberals under Malcolm Turnbull, because it was felt that the Liberal campaign wasn't resonating in the bush. Will the Nationals this time be running a similar differentiating strategy?
Well, that's a question for other people. I had the experience of having basically been the only person in political history to win back a Senate seat that had been lost and win back a lower house seat that had been lost, remembering I stood for the Senate not under a coalition ticket but just on a National Party ticket. So I had the experience under my belt of exactly how you do this, and for a degree of difficulty, I did it in two different states. So when we went for that campaign, yes, I did take a different approach, but it requires belligerence at times. It certainly requires clear identification, and I'll leave it up to others as to how they wish to run the campaign this time. We were very successful. We won every seat and picked up one on the way through. And that is the reason we have a National Party, Liberal Party coalition government, because the Liberal Party in that instance lost a bucket of seats.
So will you be advocating such a belligerent campaign? I'm sure your views would be...
Well, I would certainly be inclined to if we cannot get the Senate ticket right. This would be the first time in the history of our nation's parliament that New South Wales does not have a National Party or precursor to National Party Senator. I think that is terribly wrong. And if we have to stand alone as the National Party team or in position number three, then the only way that person will get up, especially in the light of Wentworth, and not just Wentworth, but also the by-election at a state level in Wagga Wagga, and also the by-election in Longman. This is not a case of just Wentworth. It's a case of a range of elections at both state and federal level, that it's clearly saying if you just go the way you're going to get a very bad vote. And being number three on the Senate ticket, won't get up. So I want to make sure that the National Party has strong representation in this nation's parliament, because I think that's best for our democracy.
Just unpack this New South Wales Senate problem for our listeners.
Okay, in the coalition agreement is basically the National Party was position number two on a three-party position Senate ticket. You have Liberal, National, Liberal. Now, that position was held by Fiona Nash. But when Fiona Nash lost her job due to Section 44 issues and foreign citizenship, then the Constitution says, well, the next person moves up. So then we had a Liberal Party... the Liberal Party at number three became number two, and then the next Liberal Party person came up. So we just had Liberal Party senators. And of course, now Wacker Williams is now retiring, and if we don't get position two on his replacement, or if they give us position three, well, we'd have to stand as an independent. And at position three, the only way position three gets up is if you have, once more, a parochial campaign that entices people to vote for position number three. I have won a campaign having to stand alone under our own Senate ticket, and the only way you do it is by saying different things. And sometimes that's not conducive to the overall campaign strategy. So the way around that, and I'm saying quite clearly to those who may be listening, is give the National Party number two and you won't have to worry about that.
Otherwise, go it alone with a separate ticket.
Well, yep, I'll go it alone. And I'll be doing everything in my power to make sure that people clearly understand where the National Party person is and how they vote for them.
One seat that does look somewhat precarious, I would have thought, for you is the New South Wales seat of Cowper, where you have a retiring member and former independent Rob Oakeshott, who was in the hung parliament, retired but ran for Cowper at the last election and did very well on a shoestring campaign. Now, do you think that the Nationals are really at risk in Cowper this time round?
I think that you can't take any seat for granted, and every person has to work as hard as they can. I wrote this in my book, Weatherboard 9, about the tactics of independence. It's basically to always be the commentator on policy, but not actually devise policy. You may get some amendments to policy, but you don't actually determine policy. You don't actually determine the nuts and bolts of the way a government works. And so I would be saying that in Cowper, that if you want someone who it sounds is all things to all people and commentates on everything, then an independent will be able to do that for you.
But we've seen that independents are quite fashionable, so yes, you might be saying that, but do you think message can get across?
Yeah, I do think so. I think that it has been a form of catharsis in Wentworth, but, you know, catharsis doesn't happen twice. We don't need to, you know, people have seen it.
About Mayo?
Rebecca Sharkey, but of course Rebecca Sharkey, there was a whole range of reasons there too. You had parochialism and a sort of an internecine campaign within the Liberal Party in Mayo, and that of course didn't help. But I acknowledge that once independents are in, that they usually have a because they never say anything wrong, because they only ever commentate on what's going on, so they have a resilience that stands, but they don't actually get any policy. They don't build you the Inland Rail. They don't get you the Regional Investment Corporation. They don't get you the Building Better Regions Fund or the mobile phone towers. They don't do that because they can't. They're not in a position. They're eternal backbenchers, eternally, and they're eternally commenting on the government, taking credit for what people like and blaming the government for the essential other decisions they have to make. And, of course, you know, it might be populist, but it's not, I don't think it's honest.
Now, you caused something of a storm last week when you said you would take back the leadership if it was offered to you.
Yeah, I still say that.
You still say that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, if people say, I'm going to offer you a job for your nation, would you do it? Well, of course I would. I mean, it's insincere and just tripe to say, oh, well, if someone said, would you do this job, you say, oh, no, I wouldn't do it. Because on what premise would you not try and serve your nation at a higher level? But if you're saying, am I making phone calls trying to get votes? No, I'm not. You know, and people, you know, there was going to be a spill on. Well, there wasn't. You know, and all the time you get all these, you know, the invective and the rubbish and the heat and people running around peddling little dirty stories and off it goes.
Do you think that there's any prospect that this offer will come to you before the election?
No, I don't. I don't envisage it. No, I don't.
None at all?
Well, that's really a question for other people. But, you know, I'm just... What you're really asking is, are you collecting the votes? And I'm not.
Well, I think that you can be splitting hairs here because other people may well be collecting votes.
Well, then you should ask me, you know, are you envisaging a challenge to the leadership? No, I'm not.
A couple of the crossbenchers, Rebecca Sharkey and Cathy McGowan, have spoken out quite strongly in the last couple of days against any change in Nationals' leadership.
Well, I found that really annoying because, first of all, on what premise? And, you know, is the relevance of what they are saying? And I spoke out and I saw Cathy McGowan in the chamber today. You probably got a shot of that. I do get annoyed when other people, on presumptions of issues that they really don't have all the knowledge of, start making comments because they think it somehow garners them support.
What did you say to her?
To who? To Cathy. I said, let's have a yarn. I heard, and she said she'd been misquoted, and so I said, well, let's sit down and have a cup of tea over it.
And you're going to do that?
Yeah, of course.
And what will you say to her?
I say, well, basically what I've just said to you, rather than repeat it and have everyone vomit over your radio.
Well, what these crossbenchers are saying is that there shouldn't be...
But why? Why do they say that?
Because they are arguing there shouldn't be more instability given that we've had all these changes.
Well, you know...
Including in the National Party, of course.
Well, if someone drops dead of a heart attack, I mean, what do you call that?
No one dropped dead of a heart attack.
Just leave the position in abeyance, you know?
But no one dropped dead of a heart attack. I mean, it was all their own doing.
We're talking about
changes of leadership in parties. Well, Turnbull, your party, Labor before that.
First of all, I stood down as leader, right? I was elected by the Australian people.
Do you still think that was a good idea, incidentally?
Yes, because I had to clear the air. And then the air is cleared and the issue that surrounded it, I was emphatic that I found it spurious and defamatory. And after 5 or 6 months of investigation, nothing was found.
You have no regrets about standing down?
Of course, I have.
I have regrets about the sense of that decision.
I have regrets, but it was the right thing to do. And so it's done. But, you know, at this stage, if someone said, who was elected the Deputy Prime Minister at the last election? Me. And so that's why I'm not going for numbers, but that's why I get a little bit annoyed when people say that, oh, well, you know, you're coming from nowhere. Well, I'm not coming, and even if it did, it wouldn't be from nowhere because I was the actual elected Deputy Prime Minister of Australia. If to go back to it would not be surprising because I'd be going back to the job the Australian people elected me to do.
I noticed some rural women are making it clear that they'd oppose your return, presumably at any stage. Do you think you could...
On what premise?
Well, they're just critical of you, but do you think you could face any effective veto on a sort of Me Too movement?
Well, that's a question for others. And if the premise is people assuming knowledge of something that they don't have, then that would be misfortunate because that would be saying that somebody had knowledge of something which they obviously don't. And if they're talking about basically my marriage breaking down, well, surely that was my own business.
So what would be your message in response to this? That they don't know enough?
No, or? I would say that, you know, that I have a lot of respect for the Me Too movement, but I would not belittle it by dragging every possible political movement and every possible political action to be part of it.
Do you think that if you did get that offer, become leader again, you would carry any baggage with the female population in your rural constituency?
I would certainly say I'd have to do a lot of work, you know, and I yeah, and I do that all the time. You know, I'm not saying that, but there is no one in here who's purer than the driven snow, and that includes me. And I acknowledge I'd have to do work, and I'd be working very hard and be working as respectfully as I possibly could. But I would also plead with people, don't assume that an inference is the truth or a rumour is the truth. A rumour is a rumour and an inference is an inference. And when people have investigated something and can't find something, then respect that decision.
How hard would that work be? Because I noticed, for example,
what it worries me then, Michelle, it means that all I have to do to destroy someone in politics or in media or in any part in life is make an inference about you. Michelle, you are a bank robber. I've heard that you may be a bank robber. I can't prove it. I don't know anything about it, but I'm just putting it out there, you know, and say, well, that's wrong.
But the other day, for example, you chose not to be at some rural women's function that was being held here. Why was that?
Well, first of all, I didn't choose. I don't know whether I was invited, but I didn't choose not to be there. I would have had other things on. And I acknowledge it would have been absolute burly for the media, and I just want that circus to stop. You know, why encourage it?
Nevertheless, if you were in a position of leadership again, as you say, you'd have to build bridges.
I'm saying that, but I'm repeating what I said. Don't start, if the premise is from now on rumours are facts and inferences are facts, then we're going to turn the whole show upside down, aren't we? And I think that's a pretty unfair way to go about things. I acknowledge that, of course, I've received a lot of personal damage by an inference, by something that I've said is spurious and defamatory. And, of course, I'm going to have, by reason of that, I have to do work. But I also think that's totally unfair. I acknowledge that's part and parcel of politics. On the other issue where I do deserve absolute to be admonished, and that was the failure of my marriage, that's what one I do deserve to be. Admonished. But that is my personal business. And if we go around this building, not that it's an excuse, well, there's be half the building and more in the same boat.
It's been a rough year for you. Do you still enjoy politics? Do you still see yourself here in Canberra for a long time?
I don't know. It's an incredible honour, and I do it to the best of my ability. And I've set out most of it. I suppose I collected my thoughts in my book, which I put out. But I'm not going to just, you know, overnight wander off. When I decide to leave, I'll make sure there's a a proper transition. I think the party deserves that. I'm not intending to do that imminently. And in the meantime, I'm going to be working very hard for my electorate, which I'm enjoying immensely.
But we'll definitely see you around in the next term.
I know. I'll be here in the next term, unless the people of New England make a different choice. I'll be here in the next term. And then you can come and back and ask me then what my views are.
Barnaby Joyce, thank you very much for talking with us today. That's all from our podcast for now. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Berlage. We'll be back again very soon with another interview.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.